Pioneers of Alaska, Igloo Number 4, Park and Monument Project. May the 6th to the 11th, 1960. I called at the city engineer's office for information and received some. Then went to the 4th district recorder and found no information regarding to this land. Then to the school tax office and received the serial numbers and the public land order numbers in regard to this United States Government Reserve located on Airport Road and Pega Road. Then back to the Bureau of Land Management where I received some more information and three photostats of the public land order and description data. Then I went to the Bureau of Public Roads Engineering Office and made tracings of maps with measurements of all the last certified survey taken at the time of the annexation of this area to City of Fairbanks. Turned all papers and maps and information over to Douglas Culp at his office to compile and make three copies of all the necessary papers to send to the government with the pioneer's request for this plot. And then on May the 16th, Douglas Culp had to leave town for a few days, and I picked up the papers and took them to Earl Pilgrim, and he made one map, one sketch of the map, and he typed a set of copies of the application, but they were incorrect in the description and data and the way they were written. So I picked up all the papers again, and I took them down to President Paul Grammons and let him know what I was, what I had done up to now. And Mr. Paul Grammons come up with two prints of the Pioneer Charter and copies of Pioneer Stationery to write the letter of request to go with this project. I gathered up all these papers and took them down to Warren Taylor as a member Pioneer attorney to check to see if we couldn't speed this up a little bit. And it is definitely my understanding that the pioneers would not take part in this project unless it is on a level that can't be destroyed again. It would have to be on a state or a higher level, and they don't wish to be involved in any local politics as far as this project's concerned. We want, as I understand it, we want protection for all these relics and souvenirs and monuments, and everything that has been done locally in the past has been destroyed or gradually dissipated by new people and people that don't understand the problems, and they're not civic-minded enough to want a park or a clean place where people can visit or tourists can see. So we are going to try awful hard and continue by next meeting to have some definite information and go ahead with this. The request will have to be made out in a proper form and signed by the president of the Igloo, the secretary, and the board of trustees. And then the minutes of the meeting and the vote of the Igloo will be required, the same as any other legislative action would take in order to support it and prove our intent and give the government sufficient answers for everything. I will try to have this report typewritten up before next meeting. Harry Hughes, chairman of the committee. May the 26th, 8 o'clock, at the Eielson Building in the Home Economics Room, the meeting of the Tanana Yukon Historical Society. And I will now attempt to get introductions from each of the persons present.
I'm George Schmidt, Fairbanks. Alma Matlock.
Robert E. Sheldon.
Bruce Kelly, Fairbanks.
Jim Couch, Grail.
Gilbert Thompson, Manny Hot Springs.
No speak English.
That's Mr. Einer. Private.
Janne Janssen.
Chuck Keim, college.
Hi, Butch.
What's your name?
This is Bob Sheldon, right down from the fish market.
That's Ted Loftus, in the same market.
Andy Wicken, Fairbanks.
Your name? Your name?
Florence Manville.
And your secretary, too?
Secretary Treasurer.
Okay. Lieutenant O'Valley?
Cannon, Yukon Historical Society.
Mm-hmm.
Audrey? I'm Audrey Loftus. I'm Vice President of the Cannon, Yukon Historical Society. Tonight I'm acting as President because our President, Forbes Baker, is not with us.
Thank you, Audrey.
This is recorded by Harry Hughes. Mr. Harry Hughes, you embarrass me. This is Bob Sheldon, who was born in Washington State when it was a territory, and came to Alaska in 97 with my father, headed for the gold stampede. And landed in Skagway proper about January the 2nd, although we left Seattle December the 22nd or 3rd on the old steamer Queen. Alaska has been my home ever since. You have invited me here tonight to tell you about the history of the automobiles in Alaska, of which I have had an active part since the beginning. The reason I would like to tell this story about the first automobile in Alaska that Robert Ripley said was built by a man who'd never seen one is because the story carries a moral that I think should be of interest to everyone, and especially to young people. When I left my hometown of Snohomish and went down to Seattle in December 97. There was supposed to be one automobile in Seattle. Some doctor had a small horseless carriage there that he used to take out each Sunday, I think it was, when he was off duty, and it steered with a tiller, and people referred to it as a runabout. Somebody said they called it a runabout because it would run about a block and then they'd have to shove it back to the barn. However, I didn't see it during the couple of days we laid over in Seattle waiting for our boat to sail. I didn't see it, but I would have given anything to have seen it, because things like that intrigued me and fascinated me like they do many young people. So I came to Skagway, and we were going over the mountains to the gold stampede when we were advised not to go early but to go later. So we stopped in Skagway and helped build the Bracket Wagon Road, and later the White Pass Railroad. My father had a heart attack at that time, which is one of the popular things that are happening all over the United States today. He seemed to have set a pace way back in those days, and his heart attack put him out of business and prevented him going any further. So he got sick and When he died, he left me as an estate, one of the largest estates that ever was left to any boy. He left me the entire territory of Alaska, in which to try to make a living, and in which I have been trying to collect on the estate ever since. Sometimes the collecting hasn't been so bad, and sometimes not so good. And I started in making a living for myself by selling Seattle PIs. The war was on with Spain, Spanish-American War. The scareheads were on across the top like they are today. What Admiral Dewey was doing, Admiral Slay, and the papers were sold for a nickel apiece in Seattle like they are today. And they cost 2 cents to get them to Skagway. And since 25 cents was the smallest money they used in Skagway in those days, the smallest money you could get for a paper was 25 cents. And by rushing to the gambling houses and the other sporting places where they wanted to see the headlines as soon as possible, they'd give you 50 cents or even a dollar. So I sold many papers to gamblers and Soapy Smith and other people. And the boy had no trouble making a living in Skagway in those days. Eventually, I got into the steamboat business. I liked boats and liked the water, and I got a chance to work on a little steamboat, and I became a steamboat boy. I learned about steam, little steamboats, of which most everything was steam, and there was a few gas boats showing up in Skagway waters in those days, and I learned about gas engines. In 1903, I was offered a job in the power plant at Skagway as night engineer. They ran by water power for 9 months and steam for 3 months when the water was frozen up. During that time is when I built the little automobile that is now in the museum here. And in that connection is the story that I want to tell you that has a moral. Many people have asked me, how did you come to do that at that early age and you had never seen an automobile? Well, I said, it's a long story and it's a good question, but I said, you might not think it'd look at me now, but I had a sweetheart in those days, and as often happens, I had some competition too. A very handsome young son of a prominent doctor in the town who owned a swanky horse and rubber tired buggy used to let his son have the horse and buggy in the evening when he didn't need it. And I'm tied up down at the power plant and I can't get away. So he'd pick up my girl and drive down by the power plant and drive by and do what young people are always inclined to do, sort of rub it in, if you know what I mean. And they'd toodly-do as they went by, or whatever the salutation was in those days. Well, anyone who never was in love wouldn't fully appreciate just what one goes through under those circumstances. And that's what drove me on to try to compete with that horse and buggy. I couldn't afford a horse, but there were a lot of discarded buggies in Skagway at that time. Many people left the States with a horse and buggy and were going to drive right into the Klondike with a fur robe around their knees and really pick up the gold and drive back. Well, they discarded the buggies at Skagway, used the horses to pack their supplies as far as the old horse could go. Then the horse would either drop dead or they'd kill him and go on with the packs on their back. So there were plenty of buggies to play with, so to speak. And about that time, a little gas engine came into my possession that had been in a boat. It was a 3.5 horsepower, two cycle, a single cylinder little gas engine called a Auto Marine. They were built in Detroit and sent out to people all over the country to put it in your own rowboat and have your own motorboat. The ad that came with them was that they there'd be no smoke, no smell, no heat, could not explode, a child could operate them. And two saloon men bought one and tried it. And they got a carpenter to install it in the boat. And they had the book of directions. And one Sunday they started out with the boat with a couple of bottles of whiskey and the book of instructions, and they twisted it and twisted it, then turned this and turned that, skinned their knuckles, took a few more drinks, and finally when the tide was clear out, they were several miles down the bay and the engine choked and coughed and didn't run. They finally rowed back, tied the boat to the dock and went home, and when the tide came up, why, the boat didn't come up. They tied the rope around the piling with a cow hitch of some kind. And so the engine got drowned in salt water. So the boat was picked up and put on the dock, and they took the engine out and brought it up to the power plant for me to overhaul, because I had had gas experience. And I overhauled it for them and took it apart and got the salt water out of it and got it in good running order. And they came down, wanted to know how much they owed me, and I told them they owed me $15. I'd worked on that thing for about a week or so in my spare time. $10, they said. Give us $20 more and take the machine. So I took the machine, and that was how I come to have the little marine gas engine in my possession. And then the idea was that since this engine could propel boats, could operate wood saws, could perform powers and duty, service in other ways, why couldn't I hook that up to a buggy some way and possibly run rings around that horse or scare him to death or something? Pictures of automobiles were starting to come out about that time, 1902 and 3 and 4 and 5 and so on. And I saw the magazines with those pictures in them. I didn't know much about the details, but from the pictures and with what little ingenuity I had and resourcefulness, and driven on by this terrific force known as love, I kept at it till the darn thing ran. And that's what started the whole thing, and that's how it all came about. And here's the moral. That girl was the belle of the town. She had the only automobile in Alaska. No girl could ride in that automobile without her consent. And she was really the boss of the automobiles of Skagway. She had the only one. I'd drive up to her home with the automobile and leave the old horse and buggy tied to the fence, because this automobile gimmick was a nude thrill, and the horse and buggy didn't mean so much. After doing all that for her, she turned around and married the boy with a horse and buggy. She told me she loved me better than she did him, but I don't know what she was telling him. I never did find out, but the prima facie evidence indicated she was telling him something else. Well, like often happens in cases of that kind, I felt pretty bad about it. I didn't find out for several months where the fall down came. I thought I was the kingpin with an automobile. I felt like some of these boys in the early days on the Yukon when they had a single-cylinder putt-putt in their boat. They rated with the girls up and down the Yukon more than a guy on a poling boat. And I thought I should rate higher than the man with a horse and buggy. However, people were referring to me as a genius. Why, they said a boy that can build an automobile that'll run that never saw one, well, he's a genius. At that time, I really didn't know what genius meant. I had never looked it up, and it didn't mean anything to me. I was interested in something much more interesting than what a genius might be. But I found out, like happens in most every small town, when a girl is about to, when she's going steady and people get to wondering whether she's marrying the right boy or not, some kindly old souls always go to her mother and talk to her and maybe talk to the girl. And I think they convinced the mother that there was a narrow, very narrow line of demarcation between genius and insanity. And she didn't want to be the mother of a lot of geniuses, so she got out while the going was good. The moral of the story is that when things don't go the way you think they ought to go, don't feel too bad about it, because in this particular instance, that girl's been married 4 times. She's dealt 4 pretty nice guys a lot of misery. she's still alive and not married. So there's still another possibility. I've only been married once and still happily have the same girl and still happily married. But at that time, I felt as though I'd been badly treated. And the point is, as I say, when things don't go the way you think they ought to go, just don't feel too bad about it, because maybe the Lord's got his arms around your neck and you don't appreciate it. That little automobile created quite a little sensation in Skagway. We had a lot of fun with it and ran around, and finally I decided to come into the interior in 1908. And I heaved the automobile out in somebody's backyard. I was through with it. It didn't mean anything to me anymore. And I came into Fairbanks in 1908 and went into the Northern Commercial Company's power plant, where I was engineer there for 5 years, from 1908 to 1913. I shipped the first Model T Ford touring car into Fairbanks, into Alaska for that matter, which was into Fairbanks in 1913. That was the year we had the little airplane shipped in here to show during the 4th of July celebration, and we had 4, 5, 6 days celebration, and this little airplane was brought in here to show the people what a heavier-than-air machine could do. Little Captain Martin, as Frank will remember, and others who were here at the time, with his little chin whiskers, he flew the little plane around and up here at what afterward became Weeks Field. And I shipped this little Model T Ford touring car in that summer, in by Skagway, down the river and into Fairbanks. They were selling in Detroit for $368, in Seattle for $554, as I recall, which the difference being the freight from Detroit to Seattle. And I ordered the one from Seattle shipped in here, which, as I say, came by boat to Skagway, White Pass Railroad to Whitehorse, Canadian boat down the river till it connected with the American boat, transferred to the American boat down the Yukon, and then transferred to the Tanana River boat at Tanana up to Fairbanks. And when I took it off the dock over here in front of the MC Company, it cost me $1,286 and some odd cents. I used to get 2 weeks vacation at the NC Company power plant there. In those days, engineers and power plants worked 12 hours a day, Sundays and holidays and their birthday and every other day. And they got 2 weeks vacation for 15 days. Under pay. Everybody else around the place had 52 days off, Sundays, and they had all these various other holidays off. But and they only worked 10 hours a day in those days. So I took this 2 weeks off, and all of the people around the Fairbanks area wanted to come into town for the big celebration. So I thought, here's a chance for me to have some fun. I'll take my new little automobile and I'll run out here and get my friends and bring them in. People telephoned in from Chattanooga and Clary and Fairbanks Creek and Engineer Creek and Esther Creek, and I'd go out and get them and bring them into town, deliver them to Nardale, and then they'd start wanting to ask me how much they owed me. Well, I said, you don't owe me anything. I'm on vacation. I'm just having a lot of fun here. And these people started sticking $20 gold pieces in my blouse pockets here, because $20 was, we had gold for money, $20, $10, $5, you didn't see very little paper money. And they kept loading me up with money, and I was bringing them in here, going back, get some more, go back, get some more, then taking them back out after the celebration. I took in over $1,500 in the 2 weeks I was on vacation. I was going night and day.
start getting interested in.
Your
Honor. Oh, no, just a minute.
Part 2.
Well, the money I took in during this 4th of July celebration gave me the impression there was money in the automobile business. That's what fooled me. I quit my job and went into the automobile business. My respects to Jimmy Barrick. After a few years in the automobile business, louder, Harry, louder.
9 times. 9 o'clock.
After a few years in the automobile business in a country where they had no roads, I felt like the boy whose father told him there was money in chickens. And he cut open 8 and never found a cent. And when his father got through beating him up, he got out of the chicken business. And if I'd have quit the automobile business soon enough, that's what made me what I am today, a wreck of staying in the automobile business. If I'd have stayed in the automobile business locally, like Billy Rip did, I'd have made a lot of money. But I wanted to do something spectacular. And about that time, up to 13, to get from here to Seattle in the summertime took anywhere from 28 to 30 days. Down the Yukon River, connecting with down the Tanana River, I should say, connecting with the Yukon River boats, either up or down, out by Skagway and the Inside Passage or out by the ocean. If you made perfect connections, you could get to Seattle in 30 days. 2 different friends of mine here at that time were told by local doctors to get back to Mayo Brothers just as quick as they could because they had a malignant condition developing that their only chance was to get back to Mayo Brothers. In those days, Mayo Brothers was considered the last jumping off place before you went to heaven. If they couldn't save you, you were gone. Seattle didn't have any service to offer in those days compared to Mayo Brothers. These friends of mine got back there just in time after 30 days struggle to get to Seattle, another week or so to get to Rochester, Minnesota, to be told by the doctors they're sorry if you could have got here a little sooner, we might have been able to help you. So they died. And that impressed me to such an extent that I thought if a person could get by automobile from here to the coast in 2 or 3 days and then catch a boat at Valdez to Seattle in another 6 or 7 days, you might get to Seattle in 10 days instead of 30 days, which might be the difference between life and death if your condition was of that nature. So I quit my position as engineer in the power plant, started for Valdez. I'd never been over the road. I didn't know much about it. There was bridges over the larger rivers, but no bridges over the smaller streams, the glacial streams that in hot weather are high in the afternoons and low early in the mornings. And I had to ford those streams that had no bridges of any kind by waiting till early in the morning when the water was at its lowest point and then wiggle across downstream and come up on the other side and go on your way. And I left here on the 29th of July, 1913, and landed in Valdez, July the 2nd, after a side trip down to Chittenden, besides. The papers had a scarehead there
that high, but the country was now on the verge of a new era in transportation. You now can get to the coast in 2 or 3 days, catch the boat to Seattle. But I went out in July when the road was very dry. I went out again in September after the rains came, and I was a week getting to Valdez, and I guess I overhauled that automobile about 5 times before I got out there. But little by little they improved the road, thanks to old General Richardson and the congressman who supplied the money. Little by little they improved the road until we built up our service there from 1913 on. In 1921, Mr. Galen of Cordova and I organized the Richardson Highway Transportation Company. We operated larger cars. The road was getting better. We were bringing tourists back and forth over the road. And in 25, we sold it out to other people who were interested in that business and took the concession in Mount McKinley National Park to handle the visitors there. And we introduced the automobiles there after starting in with pack horses and pack and wagons and what have you. We finally introduced automobiles there and we operated there till 1940, when conditions got so bad that we government was willing to give us another 20-year permit, providing we'd build a $250,000 lodge over at near Wonder Lake and take over the management and operation of the McKinley Park Hotel. And the average attendance there in those days was between 1,000 and 1,200 people. And we told the Honorable Secretary Ickes that since we didn't give him anything for Christmas, he could have Mount McKinley National Park and keep it. And then came the war, 41, Pearl Harbor, which put the tourist business out of business and set McKinley Park back probably a few years. I'm still hoping that it will grow and become the important part of Alaska that I have always felt that it should be. I'm hoping that we can get a road now to Point Barrow and to Nome and to other strategic parts of Alaska that will cause more and more visitors to come up here and save our country from going into bankruptcy, so we don't get some sort of industry up here pretty soon. And if there's ever any decline in this defense program, it's only the automobiles that will save us, bringing people up here to see our country. In trying to get across the street tonight, near the First National Bank at 5 o'clock, I stood on the corner and took my life in my hands. And I said, if I'd have had any idea in 1905 in Skagway, Alaska, when I cranked up this little automobile that I built the first time to make it run, if I'd have had any idea that it was going to develop into the bumper crop that's all over Alaska today, I think I'd have heaved it in the bay and forgot it. Thank you very much.